From Nevada Public Radio, I'm Paul Boger. This is State of Nevada. Clark County employs almost 200 public defenders whose job it is to provide legal representation to clients who can't afford an attorney. Those lawyers staff one of the nation's busiest public defender's offices. But on July 2nd, they were forced to evacuate their downtown Las Vegas office after tests showed PCBs had surfaced. PCBs, or polychlorinated biphenyls, are known carcinogens. They have the potential to harm thyroid, liver, and heart function. The U.S. government banned their manufacturer in 1979. The attorneys say the county knew about the contamination and the ensuing illnesses and chose not to remediate. A spokesperson for the county did not respond to a request for an interview, but they did provide a comment, which reads in part, quote, "The building has not been deemed uninhabitable. After initial testing, the county plans to develop a plan for source testing and any needed remediation," end quote. For more, KNPR's Ann Davis sat down with the president of the Clark County Defenders Union, David Westbrook.
David, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
So what is morale like right now among you and your colleagues?
I'd say probably a little bit like people who were in the lifeboats sailing away from the Titanic. First of all, it's a shock. The shock was that we were essentially given at about 4:30 on a Monday the order that we had to be completely evacuated by Thursday afternoon. A lot of people have been concerned about the building for a lot of years without knowing exactly what was wrong with the building. There's a lot of history to that.
I do want to get to sort of the current working situation in just a minute, but I want to go back to what you've said about the public defenders knowing that there has been a problem for quite a while. Was that spurred by people getting sort of mysterious illnesses and not really knowing what's going on? Was that what sort of first was the catalyst for suspecting something was wrong?
Yeah, there's been a lot of illnesses over the years in the office. We were noticing anecdotally that a lot of people in the office seem to be getting cancer or respiratory illnesses or having fertility issues. And it was very disconcerting. So our collective bargaining agreement negotiations over the last 4 years between the union and Clark County, we were trying to convince them to do testing of our building so we could determine whether or not there was something toxic inside the building that was making people sick, or if it was just a coincidence. People seem to be getting breast cancer or other blood cancers or fertility issues in the building. So when we started asking for them to do testing, we didn't know exactly what we wanted them to do testing for. Then in 2024, I came across a Supreme Court case that had just been decided. It was Atkins versus Union Pacific Railroad and Monsanto. That was the first time I actually learned what PCBs were. Forever chemicals that can off-gas and volatilize, get into the dust, get into the air, and cause diseases much like the ones that people have been suffering from in the 309 building and possibly elsewhere in other public defenders' offices for as long as I've been in the office. And I've been in the office for 21 years. It was at that point in the 2025 contract negotiation that we started asking the county specifically to test for PCBs.
And as I understand it, Clark County said no to this specific PCB testing?
They've been saying no to us for years. And even after we brought to their attention the concept that it could be PCBs in the building, they continued to minimize the problem, essentially suggest that we were imagining it, that there wasn't anything serious, or if there was something serious, we would have to, you know, demonstrate to them first that there was a problem before they would do any testing. You know, during union negotiations, we were literally asked by the chief negotiator at the time, well, if you think people are suffering from illnesses, give us all their medical records. Tell us what they've been suffering from. Give us information from doctors indicating that they got these illnesses in the building. You know, give us their medical history so we can determine that they didn't already have a history of cancer in the family. Very specific information that the chief negotiator in our contract wanted before he would even be willing to consider doing environmental testing for PCBs, despite the fact that the county has been fully aware since at least 2021 that there are PCBs in the downtown area because they were part of that lawsuit, that Atkins versus Union Pacific Railroad lawsuit. Originally, they were part of the lawsuit. So they know that there's been an issue in downtown with PCBs and yet refuse to test. Because of all of that, we started exploring doing our own testing. And that's exactly what we did.
Okay, and then how soon after that testing happened and the results came in as positive for PCB contamination, were you all evacuated? Was this a long time or did this happen fairly quickly?
It was a surprisingly long amount of time,
Really?
actually. Months passed.
Okay.
They had our testing for months. I'd have to look at a calendar, but I believe that we turned it over to them in February of 2026.
So, what, in your estimation, finally prompted the county to evacuate the building?
I do know this. 6 weeks prior to telling us we had to move, and again, we were given 3 days to move out. 6 weeks prior to that, a letter was sent from Claggett and Sykes, which is the firm that is looking into litigation civilly on this issue, informing them that they had to preserve evidence and informing them that the building was dangerous and should not be housing any human beings. The county sat on that letter for 6 weeks. They didn't do anything with it. They didn't develop a plan. They didn't find us any office space to move to. And then something put them into a real big hurry, real fast. And I'm not sure what that is. That would be a great question for county admin to answer.
What has been the reaction among you and your colleagues to learning that this was indeed PCB exposure and the county did, in fact, it sounds like, know about this? What's that experience been like?
Well, it's hard not to get sort of a sense of fear and dread when you find confirmation that there is something in the building capable of making us all sick. I mean, we've all known people in the building who have gotten cancer. People are scared about the long-term health consequences. You know, are we going to get cancer 10 or 20 years down the road?
Now, I do want to move to the new office arrangement that you mentioned earlier. What is that like now? Are you in another county building? Are you doing sort of work from home hybrid stuff? What does that look like?
Well, we took an office that had, again, somewhere around 180 people in it. And we had to move it on no notice across the street to just two floors in the Phoenix building. The interesting thing about those two floors in the Phoenix building is that they were already occupied by members of our office. They're two floors that were already part of the public defender's office. It's simply not enough space to house everybody, not even close. Right now, it's packed to the gills. We are among the busiest public defender's offices in the entire country. Our caseloads are through the roof. They're among the highest anywhere in the nation. So basically, everything about our jobs that was challenging has become exponentially more challenging simply because of proximity, lack of office space, lack of access to the courthouse. We have to travel to and from the office more times during the day. It's more challenging to talk to our clients inside the jail. It's something that's workable over a short-term period of time, like a few weeks. But if we don't have office space for an extended period of time, and all signs to point to that being the case, it's simply not tenable.
On that topic, actually, according to recent Las Vegas Review-Journal reporting, the upheaval has already caused one public defender to petition the court to delay a death penalty trial, as you, I'm sure, know. Now, the judge denied that petition, but do you anticipate that the evacuation and obviously ongoing health concerns will have an impact on the efficiency of the broader legal system here in Southern Nevada?
If we don't have our office situation addressed, I don't see how we can keep up our standards. There will be delays. There just has to be. Because as dedicated as we are and as hard as we work, I don't see a situation where we can keep this up for 6 months, for a year, without there being some kind of consequences to the final product.
Do you anticipate all of these changes and all of this upheaval and uncertainty as causing a large amount of burnout among the public defenders and causing people to actually just leave the ranks of Clark County public defenders?
That's a serious concern. This office has never been stronger from a personnel perspective. The attorneys and staff of the Public Defender's Office are great. They're operating at an incredibly high level. And I would hate to lose any of them.
I know the Clark County Defenders Union has requested impact bargaining now that this, you know, obviously changes the contract landscape. And Clark County, as you've told me, has indicated reluctance on that front. What is your hope for a resolution to all of this as you're heading into bargaining potentially in the next few weeks?
A lot of us have felt like the county thinks we're expendable. And we just saw our friends getting sick and ourselves getting sick. And we didn't know what to do about it. Eventually, we had to do something ourselves. So, yeah, I'm really hopeful that the county will work with us and get us the space we need and then take all the time necessary to either fully explore and remediate that building or to get us a new permanent home that is not infected with toxic chemicals, that has adequate office space for us to do our jobs. You know, that's all we're asking for. Give us an office. Please stop poisoning us. Those are our demands.
David Westbrook is both a public defender and the president of the Clark County Defenders Union. David, that's all the time we have for today, but I do want to thank you so much for joining.
Thank you.
And just as a quick note, Clark County is a financial supporter of Nevada Public Radio. However, our reporting remains, as always, free of the county's influence. Many communities are experiencing record-breaking temperatures this summer, with the heat especially dangerous in southwestern states. As the Mount West News Bureau's Yvette Fernandez reports in Las Vegas, officials are stepping in to help people caught in the heat, and one place they're looking is bus stops. And as a new note, the Regional Transportation Commission of Southern Nevada is a financial supporter of Nevada Public Radio.
Waiting for a bus in 109-degree heat isn't easy.
It's devastating. I mean, it's the heat. There's no relief.
Ebony Burnett uses the bus to get to her job as a home care provider.
Just got to stay hydrated and try to find shade as best you can.
At least there's some relief from the heat here at the main transit station in Las Vegas. Inside there's air conditioning. There's plenty of shade too, but still.
This dry heat is a desert.
Jewel Dunlap takes the bus to errands and doctor's appointments. She says bus riders have to be prepared in the heat.
You can die out here if you don't have water. So it's very dangerous.
In 2024, the local coroner's office said more than 500 people lost their lives due to heat exposure in Southern Nevada. That's one reason Southern Nevada secured federal funding to work on a heat response plan. Andrew Kelman with the Regional Transportation Commission says a top priority is a simple one: add more shade to bus stops.
Here in Southern Nevada, we have about 3,700 bus stops, but only half of those are covered from the sun with a shade structure.
Eventually, all bus stops will have shade, many with what's called a dual directional design, Kelman says.
It will have a shade screen behind you, like a typical transit shelter would, but it also has a shade screen in front of you. That way, regardless of what time of day it is, you will always have that protection from the sun.
In some parts of the metro area, it can be up to 11 degrees hotter.
These are areas with less green space, so less street trees, less parks, and then also a lot of asphalt parking lots. And so all of those equal hotter temperatures.
This kind of effort is taking place beyond Nevada. Cities in Arizona, including Phoenix and Tempe, have also conducted similar bus shade studies. Tempe Transportation Manager Sam Stevenson says the city began installing new shady bus stops in 2024 with a goal of covering at least 30 a year.
We have around 800 bus stops, and prior to this project, less than 40% of those had shelter.
Tempe is also prioritizing older areas where more people are dependent on public transportation.
Our new standard has four different sizes. We call the smallest one the micro. And what that's enabled us to do is to roll these out in locations that previously we may not have been able to fit a bus shelter.
Heat is not officially recognized as a natural disaster by the federal government, yet it claims more lives than any other extreme weather event, according to the American Public Health Association. While climate change may be global, action is needed locally. So officials from Arizona and Nevada gathered to share lessons learned and discuss strategies at the first heat summit held in Las Vegas this spring.
There's a sense of responsibility that comes with planning for any type of heat or climate-related emergency.
Which is one reason why so many cities are working to reduce heat injuries and deaths. In Las Vegas, Yvette Fernandez, the Mountain West News Bureau.
Along a bumpy, dusty road in the heart of northern Nevada's Lyon County is one of the Silver State's historical and ecological treasures. At roughly 1,600 acres, this former ranch spans both banks of the Carson River and includes rich riparian habitat for fish and wildlife. The site also serves as a reminder of Nevada's rich history as a haven for those seeking a divorce. And as of this month, it's also Nevada's 28th and newest state park. Right now, the park is still in the planning stage. State officials intend to develop a master plan that guides how the new park is designed and managed. That includes ensuring public access, recreation, conservation, and infrastructure are carefully balanced. And here to talk about all of that is Tyler Curver. He's the Education and Information Officer for the Division of State Parks within the Nevada Department of Conservation and Natural Resources. Tyler, welcome.
Hey, how you doing?
Talk to me about the history of the area. What makes this little corner of our vast state so interesting?
Yeah, so you kind of mentioned a lot of it. It has a huge natural resource potential. So every time I go up there, the birds are so loud. I've done a couple of videos up there and had to redo it just because the birds in the background were so loud. It also has a lot of history to it. It operated as a divorce ranch in the 1940s, which if you don't know what those are, just Google a little bit. It's a lot of fun. Some Nevada history out there.
The Carson River is gorgeous as it meanders out of the Eastern Sierra and towards the Lahontan Reservoir. Paint me a picture. You know, what is the area like?
Yeah, so you're driving along a dirt road and it kind of opens up into this nice little agricultural valley. Mountains on each side. The river's going through right in the middle. It's very beautiful. And the agriculture kind of makes it really green. The cottonwoods, there's a cottonwood forest along the Carson River. So, very, very beautiful. Very beautiful.
You know, this site has had a lot of history, you know, looking it up, connections to John C. Fremont and the settlement of the state. Then you had its agricultural history, its history as a divorce ranch, as you mentioned. You know, how did the state come into possession of this land?
So the recent landowner actually realized that they wanted to preserve it. It wasn't developable, and it should be preserved for wildlife. So they actually reached out to the Western Rivers Conservancy, which is a nonprofit that seeks just to preserve streams and rivers for fish and wildlife. So when they learned about it, they actually reached out to the Department of Wildlife, who saw the history and the recreation potential and directed them towards state parks. So they worked with state lands, and we acquired the property that way with a lot of different funds. As we kind of saw the recreation potential just out in that area and the conservation efforts.
Now, is that a normal process of essentially the state just gets donated the land? Or tell me the process that the state usually uses to deem an area worth preservation as a state park.
There's a variety of different ways. We don't really have a set list of what needs to happen for it to be a state park. In this instance, you know, it was brought to us, and then we worked with state lands to purchase the property. Once it's purchased, then internally we just deem it a state park. There could be other options. The governor can deem a state park. The legislators, our first four state parks in 1935 were designated as parks by the legislator. So that's a way to do it. And then when a property is brought to us, we look at it for its recreation, natural resource, or history. Those are the three qualities that we use to preserve an area or decide if it wants to be or if it's going to be a state park. If we want it to be.
Now, this park doesn't, we keep calling it the park, or, you know, the new park. It doesn't have a name yet. Right. You have actually invited Nevadans to help name this park. You've got a whole list there in front of you.
Yeah.
Now, the contest to name the park is closed. It closed last week. But what are some of the top names? You know, what have you gotten? Yeah. What are you looking at?
So, yeah, just a quick background on that. I mean, we did, the history of it is well known as Break a Heart Ranch, and that's, going into it, that's what we wanted the name to be. We learned very quickly that we aren't that we're not legally going to be allowed to use that name. That name and brand is being operated privately. So, not knowing as much about the area as we normally do before acquiring a property, we decided to put it out to the public. What kind of names do they want? There's got to be people out there that have lived in the area. They know things that we don't know. So,
and Parky McParkface is definitely on that list, right?
Right. Yeah. So Parky McParkface is definitely one of the top options as far as how many surveys we got. We have over about 2,500 name suggestions that came in to us, which is pretty good for a public survey in the state of Nevada. We have a lot of Carson River options. Let's see. I haven't looked at a lot of these names yet. Divorce Ranch, Lazy River.
So definitely going more towards the natural elements, maybe some of the history.
Yeah. So internally, we're gonna have to go through the names and decide kind of the top contenders that we feel comfortable calling the park. The governor's office wants to call the park, and then we'll put those top contenders out for a public vote.
So not open yet. When will the park officially open?
So before we can open it, so right now you can drive through on the county road, Fort Churchill Road. You can kind of look at it from the road perspective. But it won't be officially open at least 2 or 3 years. We're going to have to use, we need public feedback to figure out what the public wants of this park. We need to look at it, we want the park to be utilized, which requires a whole master plan process. Could be a year or two for that. Once that happens, then we have to look at the infrastructure that we need to build, what we need to remove, what we need to add to get it ready for the public safely and so they can enjoy it. So about 2 or 3 years.
You know, from my experience, it seems like Nevada's state parks are becoming more popular with residents. Is there anything to back that up? Is there any evidence for that?
Yeah. Over the last 10 years, Sand Harbor grew from, it tripled. So we're at 1.2 million visitors a year just at Sand Harbor.
Up in
Lake Tahoe. Down in Valley of Fire in the Las Vegas area, it's roughly the same, about 1 million visitors. And our data shows that those have all been upticking really quickly. We blame a lot of it on social media. People, you know, taking photos of Valley of Fire and Sand Harbor, they want to get out there as much as possible. When they go to these areas, they learn about our agency, Nevada State Parks. And right now I've been doing a really big push on our website, getting people to reserve sites on Reserve Nevada. And that has kind of opened the door to what are all these other state parks in the area.
You kind of beat me to my next point. Mm-hmm. You know, it seems like there is an ongoing effort to improve and expand the state's parks. You mentioned the reservation system. That is still relatively new. What kind of feedback are you getting with that?
It depends if you can get a spot or not. So the people, so Sand Harbor, we just recently implemented day use reservations, which was the first in the state for that to happen. It was the first beach in the Lake Tahoe area for that to happen. And the people that actually are able to get in and reserve a spot, they love it. It's, you know, it's very helpful. You don't have to wake up early in the morning anymore, wait in line at 4 a.m. on the highway to get a spot at Sand Harbor. So with that aspect, people really love it. Camping aspect, you can, you know, if you want to plan your trip to Valley of Fire and you want to drag your camper, your family out there, there's now a campground for you waiting, and you know that you have that spot reserved for you, which is very beneficial. So you don't drive all the way out there. You know, it's 45 minutes just from downtown Las Vegas, hours from everywhere else. you're spending all this time going down there. If you get down there and it's full, oh no, now you got to go somewhere else.
So I have definitely had that experience of driving all the way across the state, waking up really early in the morning and getting to a campsite just to find it completely full. So,
and that's also what's made our parks so much more popular in recent years. It's just because now there's a new demographic going out there. There's a new visitor base going out there where they can actually expect their site to be available for them.
That is where we're going to have to leave it. Tyler Kerver is the Education and Information Officer for the Nevada Division of State Parks within the Department of Conservation and Natural Resources. Tyler, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
What do you want to happen with your body when you die? A growing number of people are making that decision earlier and looking for environmentally friendly funerals. A new state law in Nevada now allows you to become compost when you pass away. KUNR's Lucia Starbuck has the story.
Emily remembers her dad as energetic, extremely kind, and a mischievous practical joker. She says he was also an early adopter of new technologies.
He bought an electric car before there were chargers. The company actually went out of business. It was pre-Tesla, like extremely early.
Due to the sensitive nature of this story, we are not sharing their full names. His wife, Julie, admires how he planned not one, but two successful surprise birthday parties for her. She says he believed everything could be used for something, just like the leaves in their yard.
He thought I was throwing them out, but in reality, I was sending them to the city to be recycled. I said, look, it's okay. I will show you their pile of leaves. Because he saw that everything that grows around us is a resource, basically created with the energy of the sun. And that this is something that shouldn't be squandered.
When her husband died unexpectedly a couple of years ago, and without advanced funeral preparations, Julie didn't know where to turn. She leaned on her daughter, who learned about a brand new company at the time, Earth Funeral, in Las Vegas. The two thought it aligned perfectly with his principles.
It felt like just the most harmonious combination between like a very clean, modern process and also a tradition that's as old as our species, where we surround our loved ones in flowers and return them to the earth.
To know that he is still in the sunlight, still contributing to the environment, makes us feel literally like he's still alive.
He was incorporated into a river ecosystem restoration project in Central California. The site is no longer an option after local leaders objected, but Julie says it still matches her husband's pro-startup personality. There's no DNA present, says Roe Hudson with Earth Funeral. The result is similar to composting coffee grounds or banana peels. The facility opened in 2024. Hudson provides tours to families, starting with a 7-foot-long green pod that looks like a tanning bed in the lobby.
I've had some people say it looks like an iron lung. It looks like something that you'd find in like a ship or a submarine. It reminds me of when you would go to the bank, those little cylinders that they'd send down.
Before being placed in the tube, the body is gently washed and wrapped in a shroud along with wood chips, mulch, and wildflowers. Hudson says the inside slowly rotates and controls the temperature, moisture, and oxygen flow as microbes from the gut break down the body over 30 to 45 days. At the end, there's roughly 300 pounds of nutrient-rich soil. Family members can receive a biodegradable urn to plant at home. The rest can be sent to Earth Funeral's current reforestation site in Washington. The human composting process is an environmental alternative to cremation, which emits carbon, while the traditional burial and embalming process can pollute soil and underground water. Anita Honig, a cultural anthropologist, has seen a pop-up of green burials.
People are increasingly looking to leave some sort of legacy. There's an idea that they want to be aligned with their values when they die and less kind of stymied by convention. Why not press my ashes into a vinyl record? Or why not put into a tree root?
Reno residents Joe Ellen and Ron Kyle have prepaid for their services with Earth Funeral.
I'd like to be a majestic oak.
I would like there to be an opportunity for a tree or two to be planted in some place where our sons and their family might enjoy it and give you an occasional thought as they prune the sucker.
Both are retired U.S. Forest Service employees. Joe Ellen says they have renewable natural resources in their blood.
Being in a restoration area feels like a good ending or new beginning if you're part of the soil.
Getting quickly back into the ecosystem is how you recycle yourself.
They say their decision to plan their funeral is a gift for their sons. Lucia Starbuck, KUNR News.
Rose lives in the Mojave, and near her childhood home of Pahrump, a solar array called Yellow Pine is going up. Joining a small group of protesters, Rose fears for the survival of the area and its wildlife, among other concerns. On the bright side, Rose is delighted that she and former partner Miles are giving love a second chance. Such is the doom and swoon dynamic of Yellow Pine, the latest book by acclaimed author Claire V. Watkins that came out yesterday, July 21st. Watkins, like Rose, grew up in Pahrump. Her prose renders the desert not with the usual tropes of harshness and desolation, but with an eye for its vitality and beauty. It's one of several reasons why critics regard her as one of the most important voices of the American Southwest. Earlier this week, KNPR's Mike Privat spoke to Watkins, also a UNR graduate and a 2018 Black Mountain Institute Shearing Fellow at UNLV. Here's the conversation.
Claire, thanks for speaking with us today.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. Claire, before we talk about you and your work, I want to bring something remarkable up. In a single month's time, you are the fourth author that we have interviewed who has Southern Nevada roots and a new release on a major publishing imprint. The other three writers, they've discussed their debut novels. You're here to talk about your fourth book. As someone who has done her time in the publishing trenches over the years, what's it like to see Las Vegas's literary scene have what kind of feels like a national moment?
Oh, it's fantastic. I think people are really hungry for idiosyncratic thought and stories and language. And I think our region has that. So it's great to see mainstream media catching on to how we talk and how we see the world. And it's a beautiful thing.
Now, this program airs the day after the release of your third novel, your fourth overall release. Yellow Pine is its title. And I'm wondering how and when did the idea for this come to you?
Really good question. You can't really tell with things like this. But the first germ of it was hearing about the Yellow Pine solar array when it was approved. I heard from this local grassroots nonprofit called Basin and Range Watch. And I had suspected that Nevada's public land would be an interesting site if there was going to be an energy transition, because, you know, it's so sunny, right? And there's so much public land. And this particular array seemed like the beginning of that process. So I started watching it. I started going out to the site before it was even, you know, stakes in the ground and getting acquainted with it. I really wanted to see what was there in case it did come to be transformed completely by the solar array. So I really wanted to learn it and to watch and see for myself what type of sacrifice that entailed.
I Love You, But I've Chosen Darkness is often wrote about as being autofiction or autobiographical fiction. I'm not sure if you necessarily agree with that sort of label, but is Yellow Pine similar in that there is autobiographical threads in the main character or even elsewhere in the book?
Yeah, it is similar in that way. I mean, the main character, her name is Rose. We have a lot in common. She also watched the Yellow Pine array being built, and we have a lot of friends in common, people who were out there gathering periodically to watch what was happening and kind of compare notes and support each other. You know, pretty tough to watch situation. So I kind of think of her as like my neighbor out in Tecopa, my fictional neighbor. She maybe lives down the street from me or something. But yeah, we definitely have a lot in common. But that's true of all my characters, really. I mean, they all come from me, so they're a part of me. I don't mind thinking of it as autobiography. I don't really know any other way to do it.
You know, you wrote in an essay earlier this year, the quote is, "Writing feels good. That's why I do it. can't be. It's more often anguish. So my question is, how did writing Yellow Pine ultimately feel for you?
Well, it was pretty hard in a way. You know, it requires very focused attention on an extremely sad situation, you know. So the land that became the Yellow Pine Array was very, very alive. And I knew it really well by the time construction started. And I knew that there were tortoises out there. But, you know, actually seeing pictures of tortoises that had been relocated and eaten by badgers, that was all pretty harrowing. And at the same time, I'm a big believer in the solace of beauty. So to take feelings of impotence and rage and exasperation and despair, and over a long period of time and sustained focus, to make something beautiful and artful, and even sometimes it ended up being very funny and very silly, and there's like slapstick sequences and stuff, that was really important.
Yellow Pine has such geographic specificity, especially with the desert area between Las Vegas, Pahrump, Tecopa. When you write stories that have that, do you find yourself frequently going back out into the desert during the writing process to make sure you got everything exactly right, you know, all the details are there? Or do you not worry about necessarily being that precise? Maybe you want to take some locational license.
I do go out there a lot. It's like my muse. It really replenishes me to be out there on the land. And Yellow Pine and that whole area, the South Pahrump Valley, is so beautiful. It's been like sustaining me for my whole life. But I don't worry so much about being correct. A lot of stuff in Yellow Pine, the novel, is true to Yellow Pine, the industrial solar array. But ultimately, I really can't let the truth get in the way of a good story. Right? If I have to choose between the god of fact and the god of art, I always obey the god of art.
Claire, I'm thinking about the character Fran. She's kind of an activist. She's out watching the Yellow Pine area as well. And she talks about the area and the Spring Mountains with this air of reverence. And Rose, hearing this, she thinks it's maybe the first time that she's heard anyone refer to it with, quote, anything other than fear poorly masked as sneering contempt, end quote. Reading it, I wondered, Claire, if you felt any impulse, for lack of a better word, to defend Pahrump Valley and the desert, which often gets dismissed a lot when people describe it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's really been one of the animating energies behind my whole writing career, is trying to insist that that land is not expendable, not sacrificable, and really by extension that none is.
You know, we're starting to see some public pushback on data centers, especially here in Nevada. The governments seem to be listening, at least somewhat, to their constituents' concerns. I'm wondering if that's making you feel somewhat hopeful.
Yes, absolutely. It's incredible to see, and to see people, yeah, just standing up against this permanent destruction of natural resources for a technology that almost no one wants and we definitely don't need, because we all remember just a few years ago getting on perfectly fine without it. And I think the fact that, you know, AI has such coercive design, like it's just being coming at our faces. Every Zoom I go to, people are like, oh, how do I stop this? I don't want it. You know, a feeling of like a sense of autonomy being violated. If I remember Nevadans, they do not like that feeling. And we know our history, right? I understand these shenanigans to be a part of the process that began at the test site and continued on with Yucca Mountain and Ivan Paul and just plunder. I think Nevadans are very, very hip to that pattern. And it's great to see them standing up and saying, you know, enough is enough. And there have been all kinds of wins in this arena. It's difficult to see them because you're saying no, right? So you can't really see a solar array that didn't get built, or that there was an Ivan Paw style facility proposed in the South Pahrump Valley at one point. So I try to remind myself that, you know, the bombs didn't stop out of like the goodness of the federal government's heart. Generations of people got arrested and, you know, more sacrifice to make that stop happening. And it did stop. Sometimes it works. It's always worth a shot.
And that's Claire Vay Watkins. She is an author from the Mojave Desert, and her fourth book, Yellow Pine, was released yesterday. She's going to talk about it on October 9th at the Writer's Block with local author Aaron Singer. Claire, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you, Mike. It's been so fun.
The NBA Summer League Series just concluded at the Thomas & Mack, but the host city remains in the pro basketball conversation. Two expansion teams are likely coming to the NBA, and Las Vegas is a leading candidate. That has spurred multiple ownership groups looking to bid on the prospective team, as well as a number of venue proposals, new and old. Here to update us on where things stand is Alan Snell, publisher and owner of LVSportsBiz.com. Alan, thanks for speaking with me.
Great to be here, Paul.
Was there anything that came out of the just-concluded Summer League games that gave more clarity as to the NBA's future in Las Vegas?
Well, Adam Silver, the NBA commissioner, mentioned that there were the usual suspects, Bill Foley and Jerry Colangelo, the two titans that are contending for the NBA franchise. But he also mentioned that there were some other groups that have not gone public that he has spoken to both here and in Seattle.
At this point, who are the serious contenders to own a potential Las Vegas NBA team?
Well, it's clear that the two big titans are definitely Bill Foley. He has the infrastructure. He has 15% control of T-Mobile Arena. And also Jerry Colangelo, who is a huge name in professional basketball. He used to own the Phoenix Suns. He knows the desert lifestyle. He knows the desert economy. He also, what's important is he ran USA Basketball, which oversaw the men's national basketball team. So you're talking about two big hitters between Foley and Colangelo.
Does Foley have a little bit of an advantage here? You know, you mentioned T-Mobile Arena. He's pledged to put $300, $400 million into making it NBA ready. Does that guy give him a little bit of the edge?
If there's one thing we've learned about sports expansion here in Las Vegas, especially major league teams, it's the venue that drives the train on this. And we've seen it with the Raiders, with their football stadium. The A's are here also because they have a public contribution helping them build their A's stadium. And in this case, Bill Foley says that, as you mentioned, he'll be putting $300 million to $400 million on updating and improving an already outstanding facility in T-Mobile Arena where his Vegas Golden Knights play. So he owns 15% of the arena. AEG Entertainment out of L.A., along with MGM Resorts International, they own the other 85%. But both have been very cooperative in working with Bill Foley, really in the 10 years since the building opened. So that, to me, gives Foley the edge.
You know, stadiums cost a lot of money, but the team itself, put this into a little bit of perspective for me. How much could the team itself, the franchise, cost?
Well, clearly, the value of this team is going to be in the $8 billion to $11 billion range in terms of a fee that will be paid to the NBA. It's the clear reason why the owners would vote eventually to approve a team in these two markets. So we're talking $8 to $11 billion. Keep in mind, I think the sale of the Seattle Seahawks of the NFL is $9 billion plus. The Lakers went for, I believe, $10 billion. So you're talking about huge, huge amounts of money that a Foley or Colangelo will have to put together.
But those are, you know, franchises that exist with a fan base. This is going to be completely new. You know, we've talked a little bit about T-Mobile. What are the other arena proposals out there? Because when we were trying to count, we don't actually know at this point how many there are.
Right. So the main other contender has been this project dubbed the Diamond Arena, Las Vegas Diamond Arena, which is across from Mandalay Bay. I think it's not too far, actually, from where the A's are building their stadium on the that would be the east side of Las Vegas Boulevard. What's interesting about that building, I thought was kind of interesting, was that there would be this tunnel that would connect kind of a part of the airport, which, as you know, is not that far at that point, and it would connect right into the arena. Again, I have to tell you, Paul, there have been some other nice renderings of other arenas. There's the LVXP proposal on the north end of the strip. People will remember that's the Wet n Wild site. That was the old Jackie Robinson Arena site that's come and gone. But probably the most legit alternative arena proposal is this Diamond Arena idea. Again, it's being pitched by a developer who has not mentioned how he would fund it or his ownership group. A representative for that group said that they're waiting to get some feedback on the NBA in terms of a timeline.
We got about 30 seconds left. Realistically,
sure.
When will we see professional basketball being played in Las Vegas?
At the earliest, 2028, which is interesting, but that's when the A's Stadium is supposed to also be open. So 2028 would be the earliest.
That's Alan Snell, publisher and owner of LVSportsBiz.com. Alan, thank you for your time.
Great to be here, Paul.
And for disclosure, the Vegas Golden Knights, MGM Resorts, and AEG, the latter two being primary owners of T-Mobile Arena, are all financial supporters of Nevada Public Radio.